session number 20937, rule 9.
I found that Trump HQ had now dropped back and had joined forward battery headquarters. I received permission to take a couple of volunteers with me, one from my crew and one from battery forward headquarters. To go and bury Ron Barlow, taking with us a crude wooden cross to mark the position. Having already given the troop commander the map reference of where he was. We made our way back up by round a route, about route to where Sergeant Barlow was, where I'd left him lying, and making use of what had previously been somebody's half-made slit trench, placed him in there and covered him and placed the wooden cross to mark the site, and then returned. Oh, incidentally, just as we were leaving, the Mooning Minis opened up again, so I think there must have been an observer, a German observer somewhere in the area, opened up again, and we made a run for it. We got clear without any trouble, and I returned to my troop headquarters, which, as I've said, was also now near battery forward headquarters. My tank destroyer was recovered by another crew and brought back to troop position, troop headquarters. All the outside stowage had been burned, excuse me, so I'd lost all my kit, all the bed rolls had been burned, and I spent a very uncomfortable night making do with what we could borrow from other people. In the morning, before first light, as had happened before, I was taken in front of the battery commander, Sergeant Major, the battery Sergeant Major, holding a torch. Battery commander read out the charge that I had deserted my post in action. I was given a very stern letter. I was asked if I had anything to say, and I pleaded guilty to the charge as stated. I was given a very stern lecture, and severely reprimanded, and that was the end of that particular affair. And I admit that that was the one occasion when I had made the wrong decision, when I had done the wrong thing, and yes, I was guilty of deserting my post in action on that occasion.
What are these torches you keep referring to?
Oh, the ordinary hand torches.
Electrical, electric torches.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure. Ordinary hand torches on the three occasions when I was tried on Simba. All three occasions, peculiarly enough, were in the morning before it got light, with somebody holding a torch to read out the charge. by the way, when it got light the next morning, tanks, I don't know whose tanks they were, in line, charged across the open ground with their machine guns all rattling away, their beezers all rattling away, to capture that hedge where I had buried my number two the evening before. I could have told them before they started off that they were wasting their ammunition. There'd been no Germans in the hedge as such. However, and so things went on. Yes, I was my number three now took over as my number two. That's Yockey Young, the chap who'd gone over the side on D-Day, voluntary, tried to undo the unravel me, Roland Matting. He was now my number two. A replacement came to join me from battery headquarters. And so we carried on carrying out attacks day after day in action. To be shelled, mortared, machine gunned was nothing. It was a daily occurrence. But then, of course, thousands of others were going through a similar type of thing. And we just had to live with it as best we could. Unfortunately, my driver, who had been going down the slope fast, on this one occasion, we were rushed to cover a piece of ground. It was said that German tanks had been seen advancing in that direction. There was nobody else there to cover that particular area. My troop was sent to plug the gap, if you like, in the line. Needless to say, we didn't see any German tanks, but we placed ourselves in positions, which meant that we were probably about 300 or 400 yards apart. That was my troop of four tank destroyers. And my particular part was what I think was a large gap in the woods, probably a large gap left to prevent fire from spreading. That was my target area. And my driver had dismounted and was lying under the front of the tank destroyer. And he was in tears. And he was saying that he wasn't going to go anywhere. He'd said this before. He wasn't going to do any more. He was finished. And Yockey Young, who was now my number two, tried to persuade him to get up and get back inside the M10. But he wouldn't. And I ordered him to get up from the ground and get back up in the M10. Nothing happened. I made as much noise as I possibly could in cocking my Sten gun, threatening to shoot him. I remember the number two looking at me and saying, "No, Sarge." I had not the slightest intention of shooting him, of course. But it had no effect on my driver. Then my wireless op told me that there was orders coming through and I was to join what we called an O group. This meant I had to report as soon as possible to a position where I knew the troop commander to be, to get orders, O group, orders group, if you like. This meant I had to move across a piece of open ground about 300 or 400 yards to get to where troop headquarters was. I was absolutely fed up to the teeth. I'd been telling the troop commander on many occasions previous to this. And by the way, this was the second or third of my troop commanders in Normandy. The first hadn't been wounded. Lieutenant Cook, he was wounded and we saw the last of him. And I'd been telling this troop commander that my driver was already over the edge and that I wouldn't be able to expect much more from him. And the troop commander said, "Yeah, I know the situation, but they've got no replacements. They've got no replacement drivers. Well, very few people who could actually drive these M10s. However, I now felt fed up with the teeth. I was sure that my driver had now packed in completely and that I wouldn't be able to do anything with him. So I took my map case and set off to walk towards where I knew the troop commander was for the old group, across the open ground and feeling utterly fed up. I heard three guns open up, three artillery pieces, could tell that easily enough. I could hear the shells coming in my direction. I could now see the troop commander together with some of the other sergeants from the troop. I could see where he was. They were exposed from the waist. They were obviously sitting in a hole in the ground. I carried on walking. I knew the shells were heading in my direction. And I literally walked through those shell bursts without even ducking. I was so fed up. I heard the guns fire again and I carried on walking, and by now I could see the troop commander waving for me to get down. I just carried on walking. I wasn't touched. Miracle, no doubt. And when I got to the troop commander's position, where he was in a hole in the ground together with the other sergeants, he looked up at me and said, "Are you trying to get yourself killed, Sergeant Howell?" And I looked at him and I said, "Still standing. Might as well be today as any other day, sir. The way we're going, we'll all be gone soon." And he said, "I know, the battery commander knows, and he will get us rested as soon as he can." He gave us our orders, which was now to go and join some infantry for another attack about a couple of miles away. I told him that my driver was finished. He said, "Will he have to carry on until I can get him replaced?" I said, "He's finished. He won't be doing any more driving." And he said, "He'll just have to carry on." Well, I knew the bloke would come to the end of the line and there was nothing I could do about it. So I walked back to my tank destroyer and took the driver's seat myself. My driver, Harry Woodward, was still lying underneath between the tracks. I drove straight off over him, leaving him where he was, uninjured, unhurt, of course, between the tracks, and joined our little troop convoy to join up with the infantry a couple of miles away to take part in another attack. When we got there on the start line, I notified the troop commander that my driver had been left behind. He ordered the troop sergeant to then take charge of my tank destroyer whilst I continued driving. It wasn't everybody who could drive the things efficiently. I was pretty good. So I now had what, as far as I'm concerned, was a restful job. No longer in charge. I'm driving. And the troop commander took charge. The barrage came down. They also included smoke. I can remember the shells as they passed over the top of us. You could hear the snap as the cap or whatever it was came off the back of the shells, so that when they landed they were smoking. Not that the smoke was very efficient, it was blowing in the wrong direction, but there was nothing new about that. And yes, I spent the rest of the day driving. That included doing what I thought was a very good job. At one point we were advancing and the troop commander said, "Do you think you could cross, get over that hedge?" And it was one of those very big high Normandy hedges. And they had some big hedges in Normandy, but it was one of the very big ones. And I knew that I could. Pointed the thing, my tank destroyer, at the hedge. And went up and over the top, nearly vertical, I think, by the time I had the thing. But yes, up and over the top. and joined up with a small crowd of infantry on the other side, who were, there was some very small areas completely surrounded by hedges. I don't know what they were used for. Little small areas of ground like that, completely surrounded by hedges. No idea what they were used for. But we were in this. The infantry were firing, engaged in a little firefight, if you like, with some German infantry on somewhere else on the other side of the hedge. I didn't see any of them, but they were firing away all the while we were there, firing at each other. We did see a German tank, but because of the high hedges, we could only just see the top of it. And we knew very well that he was looking through his binoculars, and it was only about, I suppose, 50, 75 yards away at the most. And we knew very well that he was looking through. They had binoculars on the tanks, which were like periscope binoculars. So the bloke inside the tank could look through binoculars, which were themselves poking out the top. Very good binoculars the Germans had on their tanks. And we knew he could see us. And we played a game of hide and seek with him for quite a while. When he came out in the open and appeared to be looking at us, and we dodged back along the little bit of hedge out of his way, and vice versa. We kept it up for a short space of time. Don't know how long, about half an hour, I suppose. And then because we appeared to be able to do no good where we were, and the little firefight between the infantry had quietened down, things seemed to have quietened down altogether, we hadn't a clue where the other guns from my troop were, where the other destroyers were. No idea where they were. The troop sergeant decided we'd go back to Troop HQ to try to find out if there's any more orders or whatever. And so we went back. On the way back, once we cleared that particular spot, once we'd gone back about a couple hundred yards, we got back a couple hundred yards, and there were a group of our tanks, some tank regiment, don't know which, all battened down, hatches down, and obviously expecting trouble. But and yeah, here we had been up in front of them playing hide and seek with the German tank, coming back. As far as we were concerned, we were now relaxed. We could open up our hatches and driver's hatch, and they were, the tanks all battened down as if they were going to be in action at any time. And yeah, that's the end of that day as far as I can remember. I can't remember anything else about that day. Yes, that was us finished on that particular day.
And you were with the 15th Scottish Division then?
Oh, no, no. I was with the 15th Scottish Division when my number two was killed. They were doing their advance. Yeah, oh, yeah, but I've now come to another time.
But which troops are these, do you know? Which infantry?
Oh, no, no idea. No idea. No idea where they were. No. Oh, hello. Yes, I'll go on to speak about another couple of the actions I remember taking part in Normandy. Having said that, we did take part in a lot of the main actions that took place in what we called the central sector, at places like Christo, Rosny-sur-Odon, Baron, Hill 112, Benny Bocage, and places like that. But two more battles that I remember taking part in. On one day, in the morning, we travelled about 5 miles from where we'd been laggered overnight and came to stop in an open space that the trees scattered around in the distance, under which most of them had a tank, one of our tanks. We waited there for about half an hour, and the next thing I remember is the troop commander coming back, giving a signal to follow him. So we started up and followed the troop commander, not knowing where we were going. We went through some narrow lanes, and then we were on a very narrow road, and something we came to was a burning German SP gun, one of the heavy things. I think it was called a Ferdinand. We passed this without any sight of any German soldiers or even our own troops at that point. Further along, having rounded a bend, we were now running at the foot of what seemed to be a hill, and the troop commander turned off right to go up this hill, and as we did so, we bumped into our own infantry who were streaming down the hill, and when they saw us, they were waving their fists at us and shouting at us and calling out, "Where the bloody hell have you been? You should have been here an hour ago." We found out later that they had attacked this crest and, having reached the top, started to dig in when they were attacked by German tanks who were spinning round their tracks on top of the half-dug slit trenches of the infantry. And no wonder they were streaming down the hill. And, of course, we shouldn't have been there any earlier. We'd only just received orders and our troop commander had taken us straight to that spot. They thought we were tanks, obviously, and thought we should have been there earlier. We took up positions on that crest and under the crest, and we stayed there throughout the night and were eventually rejoined sometime during the night by some more infantry. We held those positions for about 3 days. From those positions, we were able to observe when some of our Typhoons were going in to attack the other side of some trees, and some of them were shot down. Looking to the rear, we could just in the distance pick up where one of our forward airfields was, and eventually when we came off that crest, we were taken back to the forward airfield where we were able to have a clean up, a shower, and change our underwear.
Where was that place?
I don't know the name of the place itself, but I suspect it could have been part of Hill 112. I don't know. I would think it was very near, in that region of Baron, a place called Baron, I think it was very near there. Or it could have been the ridge above Baron. Going on from there, now I'll deal with what I can remember of one of the last big do's that we took part in. We'd been travelling and we stopped for the night. Early next morning we received orders that we were to take part in an attack on Mount Pincon, which was the highest feature in Normandy, well over 1,000 feet. We were told that because artillery was not in position to give support at that particular time, the barrage would in fact be our own Typhoon rocket-firing aircraft coming down immediately before we moved forward from what would be the start line. We moved off to take up our position along the road to where the start line would be. It meant turning off a main road, going down a third-class road. I remember seeing a dead donkey on that road, and we caught up with the infantry. Now, the infantry were scattered along the forward edge of a road, wood, and a small stream, which was at the foot of this Mount Pincon. And on the other side of the stream was another open space. The rocket-firing Typhoons came down and plastered the land immediately in front of us, so close that bits and pieces of the rockets were flying back over the top of us. We recognised some of these infantry as some of the boys we'd been in action with before. They were from the 43rd Division, I think the 5th Wiltshires and probably Somersets and maybe 4th Wiltshires, but we certainly recognised some of them, and they were able to tell us what had happened to some of the chaps who we'd been in action with before. They were not in a very good shape. They'd already taken some casualties. Anyway, we now had to move forward. I think this would probably have been about 10 o'clock in the morning. My troop were down, and it was just my troop engaged in this particular action. We were down to three SPs, three tank destroyers. As we start to move forward, approaching a small bridge over the stream, the leading SP had just got on top of this bridge to cross it when there was a most tremendous explosion. I was about 30 yards behind him, and behind me was the other SP of our troop, about 30 yards behind me with the troop commander on board. We didn't know what had caused the explosion. There was a tremendous explosion. We didn't know what had caused it, whether he'd been hit by an anti-tank gun or what. But we were immediately on the alert, of course, and as the smoke and dust cleared, we could observe the crew of the SP bailing out, clambering down the side. They came back to us. Meanwhile, we were scanning the distance ahead of where they had blown up in case there was an anti-tank gun or anything in sight. They had, as far as we could see, apart from them all being affected by the terrific blast, their number two had a broken leg, which was no wonder, because later, when I was able to clamber aboard that SP, the bottom of the SP was totally buckled, the tracks were blown off, the bogey wheels were blown off, and apparently there were at least four telemines, which are very heavy mines indeed, four telemines on that little bridge, and amazingly the bridge itself had not collapsed. However, the attack had to continue. The bridge was now effectively blocked, and our troop commander, we were now down to two SPs, decided that we would stop where we were until we could get more information about what was taking place further forward from the infantry. Unfortunately, very few infantry were to be seen, possibly because they'd taken a lot of casualties. We'd seen several. But anyway, about noon, we had a break, a brew up. We hadn't pulled back about 50 yards down that little road. And the troop commander then decided that we would have another attempt to get across the stream. We closed up on the stream, but there were no infantry to be seen anywhere. And the troop commander decided to wait again until he could try to get some information as to what was happening on our left and our right with the infantry. Anyway, as I remember, it was late afternoon, early evening, we crossed the stream. We found a place to cross the stream other than the bridge, which was still blocked. And once on the other side, the troop commander signaled for me to go to him. So I dismounted and walked across to the troop commander. He was himself slightly wounded. He had a bandage around his forehead. And he said to me, "How about us making a charge for the top? Just us two SPs, since we could see no infantry anywhere." So I said to him, "I don't think it would be fair on the men. I think they've had a hard day, sir, and I don't think it would be fair on the men." And he accepted that. And we decided just to stay where we were on the other side of the stream until it got dark, which we did, and then we withdrew. And that was the last of Mount Pinkon, because apparently a successful attack was put in on the other side, which did manage to reach the top. And apart from other small skirmishes that we took part in after that, it more or less brought the Normandy campaign to an end as far as my battery was concerned. I remember that now that the campaign had more or less come to an end and we weren't required anywhere on the front, while the mopping up that operation was in process, the battery were rested in a field. And of course, we were fairly exhausted by what we'd been through. And I remember I was asleep, this would be early afternoon, I was asleep, and something woke me, a noise, and I looked and saw my number two, who was the last, apart from myself, last remaining person from my original tank crew. He was in flames, ball of flames, and he was on his feet. And I nipped across together with a couple of other people and grounded him and started to tear off his burning clothing. I remember his skin from his legs was coming off and just dangling in my fingers. Anyway, we managed to smother what was burning, still left some smouldering stuff on him, and he was carted off and that was the last I saw of him or heard of him. His name was Young. We called him Yocker. He was a bombardier. Bombardier Yocker Young. One comment I'd like to make about that, he was the same person who on D-Day had volunteered to go over the side of the landing craft to try to unroll the big roll of like coconut matting, and he had got thoroughly soaked and wet, and here it was right on the end of the Normandy campaign, he was burning. And you know, I was very, very sorry to leave him, lose him. He was a very reliable man, and of course, like I say, he was the last of my original crew. Next thing I can remember is that we were told that we would be rolling off in convoy. I forget who it was with, some tanks. That was the end of the Normandy campaign, and it wasn't long before we were on the road setting off into France, into the more open country of France, together with tanks. The first place I can remember where we came to, were held up for a while